a lot of Western governments think that let's be pragmatic and work with the Taliban now together. I think it's very dangerous to do it in such a way, to hand them over all the lists of the people, because this really endangers them. And as we all also know, a lot of them are still inside the country. Majority of them couldn't leave. And I really fear, I'm worried about the future of these people, because it's not clear what is going to happen to them. And I think it's obvious that they will be persecuted by the Taliban, they will face violence. Mm-hmm. And at the end, I really wonder who will answer. But I think it's,
Imran, it might Feroz, be similar. We're going to have to leave it there, but of course, we're going to come back to you. Astra-Afghan journalist, his new book, The Longest War, 20 Years of the War on Terror. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO, Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
Hey, KBOO members. It's time once again to vote and make your voices heard. KBOO's 2021 annual membership meeting and board election is coming up. On Sunday, September 26th, from 1 to 3 p.m., live streaming from the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. KBOO members are invited to participate in a lively discussion on how to reconnect KBOO's diverse communities after 18 months of the pandemic, the role of radio in the 21st century, and the upcoming celebration of our 54th anniversary. KBOO depends on its members to help shape its operations and programming. So show your support by casting your vote and joining this community forum. Be sure to check your mailbox for your ballot and voting information. If you don't receive your ballot in the mail by September 13th, please contact the membership department or vote online at kboo.fm. Ballots cast by mail must be received by Friday, September 24th. The deadline to vote electronically is September 19th and will reopen during the annual meeting in lieu of voting in person. If you are not a member, you can become one today by going to kboo.fm and clicking the Join Now button. Again, that's KBOO's 2021 annual membership meeting and board election on Sunday, September 26th from 1 to 3 p.m., live streaming from the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. More information about the annual meeting, candidate bios, and online voting forms can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2021. That's kboo.fm/meeting2021.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland officials announced that all city employees must be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 by mid-October. Portland police identified the man fatally shot by officers on Friday morning as 30-year-old Alexander Tadros, and the city of Portland rejects a land use endorsement for Zenith Energy's petroleum terminal in Northwest Portland. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 30th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. The Portland Police Bureau identified the man fatally shot by officers Friday morning in North Portland as 30-year-old Alexander Tadros. Tadros is the third person Portland police have killed this year. The incident started after officers responded to a North Portland apartment building to support Federal Drug Enforcement Administration, or DEA, officers who were serving a warrant. Tadros shot through a wall of the apartment building, striking a PPB officer in the hip, and Howery and Ramsey, the officers, returned fire. A PPB spokesperson did not confirm whether the officers also returned fire through the wall of the apartment building or if they saw Tadros before shooting him. According to the Oregon Medical Examiner, Tadros died from a single gunshot wound fired by an officer. The PPB officers who fired their weapons, Joshua Howery and Jake Ramsey, are both on paid leave while the Bureau investigates the shooting. The City of Portland declined on Friday to certify that Zenith Energy's petroleum terminal in Northwest Portland complies with the city's land use rules. This creates an obstacle in Zenith's efforts to renew a state air quality permit for the site. The company bought the former asphalt refinery for $61 million in 2017. It uses the 48-acre facility to store fuels before transferring them to ships bound for refineries and other markets. Zenith is a Houston-based company, and it agreed in April that it would only store and transfer renewable fuels and non-fuel using the new infrastructure the city permitted it to build at its rail terminal along the Willamette River. The company also agreed to submit to regular testing by an outside firm it must hire to ensure that it complies with those restrictions. But the city maintains that Zenith's plans violate Portland's zoning code, which bars expansion of large fossil fuel terminals. As recently as 2019, the company allowed millions of gallons of Canadian tar sands crude oil to be transported through and stored in the city. Portland City Commissioner Dan Ryan runs the city's Bureau of Development Services, which issued Friday's denial. Ryan said the city's ruling reflects Portland's commitment to environmental stewardship. He said, quote, "The decision goes well beyond the confines of one council office or bureau. We all stand united in the affirmation of the City of Portland's commitment to pursuing a clean energy future, addressing climate change, and reducing our dependence on fossil fuels," end quote. Zenith says it plans to appeal the city's ruling. Oregon's unemployment waiting week will return on Sunday, September 5th. This means people filing their initial unemployment claims on September 5th or later will once again have a waiting week before being able to collect unemployment benefits. The waiting week was waived in the early COVID pandemic when Governor Kate Brown declared a state of emergency. She then waived the waiting week until the federal program's end, which is occurring on September 4th. The waiting week doesn't impact the number of weeks a person receives in benefits or the total amount that they can be paid. Oregon Employment Department officials believe the return of the waiting week will affect about 11,000 people initially, including those filing a claim for the first time or those receiving pandemic emergency unemployment compensation benefits who were eligible for a regular unemployment claim after their original claim expired. Anyone filing for the first time after September 4th will have to wait a week to get their benefits. During the waiting week, new filers still have to look for work and file a weekly claim, but they won't be paid unemployment benefits at the end of that week. People getting regular unemployment checks will not have a waiting week, but if they file a new claim later, they will have to wait a week. The City of Portland is set to require all its employees to be vaccinated against COVID-19. According to a letter from the city, employees have until October 18th to get vaccinated or face termination. Under the policy outlined in the letter, the city's roughly 6,800 employees will have until September 10th to submit proof that they're vaccinated, that they're in the process of becoming vaccinated, or to apply for an exemption for medical or religious reasons. Many state employees in Oregon, along with Multnomah County employees, are also required to be vaccinated. With the policy, Portland will become the latest city to require public workers to get vaccinated, joining San Francisco, Chicago, and New York City, among others. As the Delta variant continues to sicken unvaccinated Oregonians at a worrying pace, two counties in Oregon have asked the State Office of Emergency Management for refrigerated trucks to handle an increase of COVID-19 deaths. Tillamook and Josephine counties both requested the trucks to hold fatalities due to the coronavirus pandemic. Tillamook's only funeral home has capacity for just 9 bodies and has spent the last week at or near capacity. The Delta variant is also causing pediatric COVID-19 hospitalizations to surge. Across the U.S., children are being hospitalized with COVID-19 in record numbers. According to the Oregon Health Authority, nearly 500 kids in Oregon between the ages of 0 and 5 tested positive for COVID-19 during the week of August 15th. Overall, the Health Authority has reported 33,661 total COVID cases involving people under 18 in Oregon since the state began keeping track. The European Union will recommend its 27 nations reinstate restrictions on tourists from the U.S. due to rising COVID-19 cases in the country. The decision by the European Council to remove the U.S. from its list of safe nations for non-essential travel reverses advice that it gave in June, when the bloc recommended lifting restrictions on American travelers before the summer tourism season. The guidance is non-binding, so U.S. travelers should expect a variety of travel rules across the continent. The EU also removed Israel, Kosovo, Lebanon, Montenegro, and North Macedonia from its safe travel list. The European Council updates the safe travel list based on criteria related to coronavirus infection levels. It gets reviewed every 2 weeks. The threshold for being on the EU list is not having more than 75 new COVID cases per 100,000 inhabitants over the last 2 weeks. Last week in the United States, new coronavirus cases average 152,000, and coronavirus deaths have been over 1,200 a day for several days, 7 times higher than they were in early July. The U.S. has yet to reopen its own borders to EU tourists, despite calls from the bloc for the Biden administration to lift the ban. A recent survey of voters in Washington state found that nearly 3/4 are at least somewhat concerned about a surprise medical bill. Eric Tegedoff has more.
The COVID-19 pandemic has put into sharp focus the quality of health care for Washingtonians. According to a new poll, more than 3/4 of Washington voters believe the amount they pay for health care every year is going up. Ian Stewart of EMC Research, which helped conduct the poll, says cost is a barrier, noting that 60% have struggled to pay for a medical bill, even with health insurance.
No surprise, expense is a big concern, and we know this because voters have faced these expenses repeatedly. They see costs of healthcare rising, and there's also a surprising number of people who have experienced challenges with paying their bills.
Stewart notes Washingtonians also are very concerned about junk plans that don't cover much care. 87% of respondents say insurance companies shouldn't be allowed to sell them. He says there is also interest in capping profits for private insurance companies, even among a majority of Republican voters in the state. The poll was conducted last month by ALG Research and EMC Research on behalf of Consumers for Quality Care. Surveys also conducted this year on behalf of Consumers for Quality Care underscore the role the pandemic has played in shaping voters' opinions of the healthcare system. Jim Manley with Consumers for Quality Care says the polling shows more than 8 in 10 Americans believe COVID-19 has exposed flaws in the healthcare system.
Obviously, the pandemic is driving a lot of healthcare-related issues, but I think it's pretty clear that, especially in the wake of a COVID pandemic, voters want to make sure that their insurance is affordable and protects them, especially if they have pre-existing conditions.
Manley adds voters nationally say they want elected officials to support legislation that keeps insurance deductibles low enough so they don't get in the way of receiving quality care. 92% of voters in Washington state agree. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
Philadelphia International Airport became the second in the country to have refugees arriving from Afghanistan amid the crisis in Kabul. Emily Scott has the story.
Several hundred refugees from Afghanistan started to arrive at Philadelphia International Airport this weekend, only a few days after an explosion at the airport in Kabul resulted in the death of at least 170 people, along with 13 U.S. service members. It became the second airport in the country after Dulles International Airport near Washington, D.C., to welcome Afghan refugees after the fall of Kabul to the Taliban. Catherine Miller-Wilson of Refugee Resettlement Organization Hyas, Pennsylvania, says under normal circumstances, they receive between 10 days and 2 weeks' notice from their national organization about upcoming refugee arrivals in the region.
What has happened because of the crisis is about 2 weeks ago, we started getting emails from our national saying, hey, be prepared. We're going to be sending you emails with like just a few hours' notice of people who are cleared to be resettled.
Afghan evacuees who don't have green card status or citizenship could end up at nearby Joint Base McGuire-Dix Lakehurst in New Jersey. The military base joins 6 others in the country housing refugees and has the capacity to hold 9,500 people. After their arrival, Miller-Wilson says Hyas PA has 90 days to help them find housing, open a bank account, secure a job, and much more. Hyas PA is asking for monetary donations to help pay for hotel rooms and other temporary housing. Miller-Wilson says they're also in need of volunteers.
We are looking for volunteers for various aspects of resettlement, things like going to the airport to pick them up, doing a housing setup where we set up their new apartment with all the furniture, accompanying clients to their first medical appointment.
City officials have also put out a request for interpreters who speak Dari, Pashto, Urdu, or Farsi to join the Philadelphia Medical Reserve Corps, a group of more than 2,500 volunteers who assist during public health emergencies and large-scale events. I'm Emily Scott with Keystone State News Connection.
In 5 months, the pandemic pause on student loan repayments will come to an end. Some advocates are pressing for reform before the student loan repayment deadline. Suzanne Potter has more on that story.
In January, student loan borrowers will have to start paying off their loans again as the pandemic-related pause on payment is set to expire. Now, a new report looks at ways to fix problems in the student loan system. Report co-author Michelle Domino says the repayment programs are far too complex, especially for teachers, health workers, and social workers who apply for the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program.
Right now, only about 1% of applicants who are submitting for Public Service Loan Forgiveness are actually seeing those applications approved.
The report also found that the income-driven repayment plan is reaching far too few people, and many borrowers become discouraged when their payments only cover the interest and not the principal on their loan. In the U.S., 45 million borrowers are struggling under $1.6 trillion in student loan debt. Domino says now is the time to consider proposals to cap interest on student loans, to limit interest to the amount required to service the loan, or to transition to upfront one-time fees instead of charging interest.
It's an opportunity in the lead-up to the lifting of the repayment freeze to really think about whether there are alternatives to interest, lower interest rates, grace periods with interest, or other policies that could help to ensure that borrowers are actually paying down the principal that they've taken on.
Starting in October, the U.S. Department of Education's new Committee on Student Loan Reform will tackle these issues in a monthly series of meetings. The hearings will be open to the public via live stream. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. This is Suzanne Potter reporting. Find our 8 trust indicators for accuracy and transparency at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Department of Environmental Quality's proposed rules, which environmental advocates say fall short of climate needs. We'll follow that up with COVID Noise Filter, debunking myths about COVID-19. At 6, stick around for Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 56 degrees. Tomorrow, those clouds are continuing with a high of 71. Today in history, in 1967, Thurgood Marshall becomes the first African-American to be confirmed as a Supreme Court justice. He would remain on the Supreme Court for 24 years before retiring for health reasons, leaving a legacy of upholding the rights of the individual as guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. The quote of the day is from American jazz singer Ella Fitzgerald, who said, quote, "Just don't give up what you're trying to do. Where there is love and inspiration, I don't think you can go wrong." President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden attend the return of U.S. service members' remains at Dover Air Force Base. A U.S. drone strike targeted a Kabul vehicle loaded with explosives, and Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards requests a major disaster declaration due to Hurricane Ida. With more on these stories, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Without specifying any future plans, I will say that we will continue to have the ability to defend ourselves and to leverage over-the-horizon capability to conduct counter-terrorism operations as needed.
Saturday, Major General Hank Taylor said a U.S. drone strike had killed 2 high-profile ISIS-K targets and wounded a third in the first known U.S. military action since Thursday's deadly suicide bombing at the Kabul airport. A second drone strike on Sunday hit a vehicle loaded with explosives that officials said posed an imminent threat to the airport. That strike also set off a separate explosion in the residential neighborhood. CNN quotes a relative as saying 9 members of one family were killed by the blast. The network reports that those killed included 6 children, the youngest being a 2-year-old girl. The U.S. Embassy issued a security alert over the weekend stating that Americans should leave the airport area immediately. Also Sunday, President Joe Biden and the First Lady attended the dignified transfer of U.S. service members' remains at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. The Kabul airport attack killed 13 service members from 10 states, including 4 from California. The blast killed at least 170 people in total. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards has requested a major disaster declaration as his state continues to be pummeled by Category 3 Hurricane Ida.
As predicted by the National Weather Service, this is one of the strongest storms to make landfall here in modern times.
Edwards said 5,000 National Guard troops were being staged in 14 parishes for search and rescue efforts with high water vehicles, boats, and helicopters. 10,000 line workers are on standby to respond to electrical outages. Hundreds of thousands of people are already without power. At the FEMA headquarters in Washington, D.C., FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell said they expect catastrophic impacts from the storm. President Biden said they were praying for the best and preparing for the worst.
As soon as the storm passes, we're going to put the country's full might behind the rescue and recovery.
Voting rights advocates called the passage of federal voting legislation at a March on for Washington and voting rights rally in Washington, D.C. The rally coincided with the 58th anniversary of the March on Washington led by Martin Luther King Jr. Tyleek McMillan of the National Action Network spoke on the National Mall.
And we demand and we require from these streets to those seats that the United States Senate pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, that the United States Senate passes the For the People Act.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
El Camino Real mission bells are removed in Santa Cruz, California. An indigenous doctor is named leader of the Canadian Medical Association, and the United Huma Nation assesses damage from Hurricane Ida. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Santa Cruz, California became the first city in the state to remove all its El Camino Real mission bells. Christina Honested has more.
Hundreds of people gathered in Santa Cruz to commemorate the city's taking down of its last El Camino Real mission bell. They were placed in and around 21 missions in California, from the San Francisco Bay Area south to Los Angeles, more than 100 years ago, as a means to promote tourism to the missions. But Native American descendants of those enslaved in the missions say those symbols glorify the Catholic Church's genocide. Mary Lopez Kiefer is with the San Luis Rey Luseño tribe.
The mission bells, whenever I hear them, I have an overwhelming feeling of anxiety. That's historical trauma. It pains me to hear a mission bell.
That's why the Santa Cruz City Council voted unanimously to remove the bells after descendants of Native Americans enslaved in the mission system demanded truth and reconciliation. This day, people gathered for the removal of the last bell in the city, making Santa Cruz the first in California to remove its mission bells. Valentin Lopez is chair of the Ama Mutsin tribe, whose ancestors historically lived in the Santa Cruz area.
Slavery of California Indians was legal in California to 1937.
People then marched to the last mission bell for its removal to find it already gone. Someone had removed it hours before the ceremony, according to local authorities. While California tribes, like the Ama Mutsin, say they want the state to follow Santa Cruz's lead and remove the remaining mission bells, someone else might beat California to it. I'm Christina Honested reporting for National Native News.
For the first time, an indigenous doctor will become the head of the Canadian Medical Association. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Dr. Alika LaFontaine has been a successful anesthesiologist who was once told he would not graduate from high school.
Dr. LaFontaine says he's excited about his new job as president-elect of the CMA. LaFontaine was born in southern Saskatchewan, but his was not an easy childhood. He suffered with a stutter and was labeled developmentally delayed. He was told by the school administrator that he would never graduate high school. He says the experience helped him, and he was determined at that moment to succeed. He was homeschooled and played in the family band. His nomination to the CMA was announced earlier this year, and the organization focused on his achievements, which included co-leading the Indigenous Health Alliance, which involved 150 First Nations as well as several national health organizations. LaFontaine says disparities in health care for Native and non-Native people have been around for a long time.
One of the things that COVID's given the opportunity to everyone is to understand the good things that happen within the healthcare system and the negative. COVID's really magnified both of those things. And so there are things that we are doing well when it comes to Indigenous health and that we keep on doing better. But as far as outcomes, we still have quite a bit of ways to go.
LaFontaine's nomination was recently ratified, and he is now officially the president-elect of the CMA. He will begin as president in August of next year. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The United Houma Nation in Louisiana is assessing damage from Hurricane Ida. The tribe's asking its citizens to check in and assess their needs. As of early Monday morning, the tribe posted on social media that the damage is overwhelming as cleanup begins and resources are sought. The 6th Parish Service Area is under a state of emergency. The United Houma Nation is the third largest state-recognized tribe in Louisiana. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A wind farm off Long Island will create new jobs for the area, but a local advocate says the industry must work with the community and unions to ensure that those jobs are high quality. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Job hunters in Sunset Park, Brooklyn may soon have new opportunities. New York State recently selected a company called Equinor to build 2 offshore wind farms near Long Island, New York. That means the state will now have 5 offshore wind projects underway. And they're expected to create both clean energy and jobs. The industry plans to use a marine terminal in Sunset Park as a hub, first for staging and assembling the wind turbines, and later for operations and maintenance.
We have a huge opportunity here to create good career jobs for people.
Maritza Silva-Farrell is with ALINE, the Alliance for a Greater New York. The group works to address both climate change and income inequality. She says in Sunset Park, good-paying jobs are scarce, and many residents lack pensions and other benefits. The wind farms could help change that. Equinor says it will spend about $50 million on workforce training. So Silva-Farrell is optimistic, but she says the industry will need to work with unions and community groups and focus on the quality, not just the number of jobs.
It has to be with a thought out process of how those jobs have pensions, benefits, health care, and really economic mobility for the long term.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 30th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Nadia Ramlagan, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, we'll hear Times Like Now with Trevor Collins. And at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews artist Intizar Abioto about her family's residency at Building 5 in Northwest Portland. All of these wonderful KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth report on the Department of Environmental Quality's proposed rules that environmental advocates say fall short of our climate needs.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Oregonians have been feeling the effects of climate change the past year. Whether it was the cold snap, the heat waves, drought, or the prolonged wildfire season currently raging in the state's forests, the state's lead environmental agency, the Department of Environmental Quality, released regulatory language for its climate protection program recently. It was created to meet an executive order by Governor Kate Brown, but environmental advocates say it falls short with loopholes for major polluters and little consideration for equity. I spoke with some environmental advocates to learn more.
This is Erica Morehouse. I'm with Environmental Defense Fund. I'm a senior attorney that works in our U.S. climate program.
And my name is Allie Rosenbluth. I'm the campaigns director at Rogue Climate, which is a grassroots climate justice organization based in Southern Oregon in the South Coast. And I also serve on DEQ's rulemaking advisory committee for these greenhouse gas regulations we'll be talking about today.
Very cool. So yeah, let's jump into that. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality recently released regulatory language for its climate protection program, which is intended to be a significant part of the state's strategy for meeting climate goals. Before we get into the benefits and limitations of what has been proposed, what does the regulatory language encompass and why does that matter?
Thanks for the question. So it matters because the agency is responding to an executive order that Governor Brown put out in March of 2020 that called on all of the state agencies to use their existing authority to meet a set of science-based targets so that Oregon could get on track to be able to address the climate crisis and do its part. So this set of regulations come from the environmental agency within Oregon that is responsible for climate and air quality regulation. And so they should really be a foundation for ensuring that the state can meet those targets along with the other actions that are happening at other agencies.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I would say is what's significant here is this is the first time the state of Oregon is looking to regulate climate pollution in the state of Oregon and really looking at the fossil fuel usage in our state and how we can begin to reduce that. Unfortunately, these rules really fall short and they leave out loads of polluters. They give polluters opportunities to buy their way out of actually reducing pollution where communities need it most. And so we are pretty disappointed with where these rules are at now. However, we are excited that, you know, Oregon is taking its first step to address this pollution that we know doesn't just harm our climate, but harms environmental justice communities who live on the front lines, who live next door to these polluting facilities, and who are experiencing the public health and safety impacts every day.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. Equity was a center focus of the climate legislation that was passed by the Oregon legislature this session. So how does equity and environmental justice factor into the climate protection program? Are the protections for that sufficient?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Rogue Climate was part of the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign that worked so hard to ensure that in our 100% Clean Energy for All bill, equity was always centered. Unfortunately, in this greenhouse gas rulemaking process, we have seen DEQ really fall short in its promises to uphold equity as one of its main goals. So I think the biggest example of this is just the amount of exemptions that DEQ is making from this program. So DEQ has proposed to exempt the entire electric sector. So that's frack gas power plants, which are the largest polluters in the state of Oregon. They are proposing to exempt methane leakage from pipelines, the pollution from compressor stations, and liquefaction facilities of natural gas. So that means DEQ's proposed greenhouse gas rules would actually give Jordan Cove LNG a free pass to pollute if it was ever able to be built. So they're really opening the door for polluters to continue polluting without consequence, which is not how we get effective climate action and effective action to reduce the harmful co-pollutants that we know are harming communities at these facilities.
I would add from the national and global perspective that we do know that low-income communities of color around the world are going to be disproportionately impacted by climate change. So the exemptions that Ali is speaking about also really matter in terms of whether Oregon is meeting its overall climate objectives. We need a program that covers polluting sources and puts a firm limit on carbon pollution so that Oregon can do its part in the global fight over that we is really critical over the next 10 years and can affect and benefit the local communities that are at the front line of pollution, as Ali's mentioning.
Yeah, so speaking of this rulemaking process, what was that like? Who is in on it and what are their interests?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I was one of the few advocates at the table. The majority of the rulemaking advisory committee was really made up of people who had interests in fossil fuels, whether they were fossil fuel corporations themselves or industry that rely heavily on natural gas. That is who was at the table, along with some of our partners, including Verde, Coalition of Communities of Color, and a few more. But, you know, month after month, when we would come to these, you know, 8-hour-long Zoom meetings, we just continued to not be listened to. Community members would show up and testify. They would say, hey, you can't leave out the largest polluters in the state because that disproportionately impacts communities of color, low-income, and rural communities. And it doesn't take action on climate the way that this executive order says we should. But month after month, we saw DEQ continuing to weaken the rules, to create more exemptions, to open up more loopholes for polluters to continue polluting instead of real climate action, which we know means reducing the combustion of fossil fuels, especially in these largest polluters in the state who are able to continue polluting through the way the rules are written currently.
And you've both mentioned that there are a few types of polluters that aren't included in the caps on emissions that are set by the DEQ, namely industrial emitters and electricity plants that export power out of state. What is the impact of their exclusion?
The biggest impact will be that those polluters don't have a firm limit on their carbon pollution. So in terms of the exporters, they're not regulated at all. The industrial polluters will basically have the opportunity to say what they think they can do, which is not a very motivating way to create actual reductions, and they will not have any firm obligations to reduce their emissions.
Another impact that I see of this, especially in regards to the industrial polluters, so those are, you know, plants that are creating, they're manufacturing, and they're using a lot of fossil fuels to be able to do that. So for folks to kind of have an idea in their head what these industrial polluters are, because there's no limit on how much the industrial polluters can pollute climate pollution, there's also an opportunity for new industrial polluters to come in without really any sidebars of ensuring that, you know, we're reducing the amount of climate pollution coming from that industry, or even that we're not adding new industry, new facilities that do harm to the communities that they're proposed in. So I think when we think about this program, right, we're thinking about the climate pollution, right, that's, you know, methane and CO2, carbon dioxide, that's entering our atmosphere to warm our planet and cause, you know, the devastating wildfires we've seen, drought, the heat wave. You know, everyone in Oregon is experiencing it, especially communities who are on the front lines. But we also have to think about this program in terms of what are the co-pollutants, so the pollutants that come along with these greenhouse gases that are happening at these plants. We know that when we reduce greenhouse gases, we can also have a really big impact on communities nearby these facilities. So, you know, we have the opportunity to strengthen these rules to ensure that not only we're taking real action on climate, but also that we are reducing the harm that is happening to communities who live near these facilities by reducing these co-pollutants that can be carcinogenic, that can cause asthma, that can have a really big impact on people's day-to-day lives, and we know are having a big impact on Oregonians' lives, especially Oregonians of color, indigenous communities, and rural and low-income communities.
Yeah, and kind of to that point, the Environmental Defense Fund found that the proposed approach to the cap allowance program would give out-of-state oil companies $14.3 billion in free allowances or free pollution over the course of the program. And so you spoke to this a little bit, but what should the policy aim to do instead?
One of the tricky things about this policy is that it is happening through executive authority. There were multiple efforts to pass legislation. So we think that the policy has fallen short in terms of finding creative ways to make sure that all Oregonians are going to benefit from the value that is created by this program. It's going to create some small investment opportunities that should be targeted at the most impacted communities. But that really is a drop in the bucket when you compare it to the numbers you mentioned, the billions of dollars of value that are going to be given to businesses for free that they could either just use to pollute for free or that they could actually trade and monetize and turn into cash. So we think that DEQ should have done a better job of ensuring that those businesses have to be responsible for the value that they're receiving and finding more ways to invest in communities.
Luckily, we do have an opportunity to strengthen these rules. Right now, we are in a public comment period where community members can send in their concerns and what they want to see changed about this program to DEQ. And there are also going to be two public hearings in September, one on September 22nd and one on September 30th, where community members will be invited to testify to DEQ and the Environmental Quality Commission about these rules. If folks are interested in that, I would recommend checking out Rogue Climate's Facebook and website for information about a workshop to get everybody prepared to speak at these hearings on September 21st. We don't have details yet, but we are working on it with some incredible partners who have also been really concerned about these rules.
And I would add, in terms of what listeners can do and what they can ask for when they do raise their voice, the idea that businesses are getting all of this value for free, one big ask would be that DEQ actually strengthens the ambition of the program so that they lower the limit of climate pollution that they're allowing in this current program, which will actually mean that the polluters will be getting fewer free allowances, fewer sort of cash value and ability to pollute for free, and could also increase the ability to invest in communities and create those kind of value and investment opportunities especially for the communities that need them most.
Yeah, thank you for highlighting that. So you mentioned that, I mean, this rulemaking process, the regulatory language, is a result of executive action by Governor Kate Brown. So what is her responsibility? What is her role in the way that this is executed? Is that something that she has approval over?
Governor Kate Brown isn't the final decision maker on these rules. The Environmental Quality Commission, who oversees this agency, DEQ, will be making a decision on whether or not to approve these rules after they're revised after the comment period in November or December. But Governor Kate Brown's executive order definitely directed the state agency to start developing a climate protection program, and we think that her office should be speaking out about these rules, because right now they currently don't reach the mandate of the executive order. They are far below it in the climate reduction goals, and then also just how many exemptions exist in the program. So we really think that Governor Kate Brown's office should be working as hard as possible to adapt these rules to become stronger, to reduce more pollution, and also create more benefits for environmental justice communities who are on the front lines of climate change and polluting industries.
And I would just add that the Environmental Quality Commission members who will be voting on this are appointees of the governor, so she obviously could have a lot of influence. And Governor Brown has put out this executive order, has put Oregon forward as a climate leader. She had a recent New York Times article asking Congress for climate action and noting the activities and the progress that Oregon has made. And we think that her voice actually creating actions that will back up the commitments that she's made are really critical, because we have to have laws on the books that will actually limit pollution at the levels that she has indicated Oregon is committed to.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Anything we didn't get to cover?
One thing I would say is that I think a lot of us, probably a lot of your listeners, I know that as a parent, I have a lot of climate anxiety, and it is easy to feel disconnected and disempowered. This is a situation where people can raise their voices, can ask for specific outcomes, and really have an impact. This is a chance to take real action that will affect the climate this and our ability to address it. So I feel really empowered every day knowing that there's things that I can do and actions that I can take that I'll be able to tell my kids that here's what I was doing. So I just really encourage all of your listeners to take that opportunity and raise their voices on this.
We are having a comment writing workshop online Monday at 6 p.m., so after this airs, to help people write comments to DEQ. It will be online, and folks can register by going to Rogue Climate calendar, our event page, or there is a short link, which is bit.ly/0830_CPP.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really appreciate you both taking the time. That was my conversation with Allie Rosenbluth, the campaigns director at Rogue Climate, and Erica Morehouse, senior attorney with the Environmental Defense Fund. Find links related to this story on our website, kbu.fm. This has been KBU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for COVID Noise Filter.
My name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
Nebraskan counties no longer reporting COVID data. In June, Nebraska stopped uploading data to the state COVID dashboard. Now the state's county health officials cannot publish COVID-19 data at all. According to the Lincoln Journal Star, this is because of a state law that prohibits releasing data on communicable diseases that could reveal the identity of any individuals involved. While Nebraska does not have a set benchmark for this, federal safe harbor laws say that any county with fewer than 20,000 residents cannot publish this information. Throughout most of the pandemic, the law was temporarily overwritten by an executive order, but this expired in early August. And because 76 of the state's 93 counties have fewer than 20,000 residents, most of the state can no longer report COVID data at all. This is even affecting counties that do not meet the population benchmark. Some health districts that can cover multiple counties are only able to report on one or few of them. And because of this, one health district had to stop publishing its COVID risk dial. While the state's 17 largest counties make up more than 3/4 of the Nebraskan population, these unrecorded rural counties have lower vaccination rates and are at a higher risk for dangerous outbreaks. While this data could be vital to the state's pandemic response, no officials in Nebraska have come out with a plan to reinstate the executive order. Instead, the state will begin releasing a weekly COVID report through its Department of Health and Human Services, giving some information about cases, hospitalizations, and vaccination rates. COVID resurgence sends more young people to the hospital. As the Delta variant has spread throughout the nation, some doctors working in areas with high COVID rates say they've seen more hospitalizations of patients in the 18 to 36 demographic. As reported by the New York Times, they also seem to be getting sicker faster than young patients did last year. Doctors have described them as younger, sicker, and quicker. Some physicians think that the Delta variant itself is playing a part, but a few studies abroad have found that there is substance to the claim that the variant can cause more severe disease, but no evidence to suggest that it is worse for younger adults. It's also likely that the more severe cases are due to lower vaccination rates among young people. More than 80% of seniors in America are vaccinated, while less than half of those 18 to 39 have been inoculated. The vaccines have been shown to be incredibly effective against more severe illness, a protection many young people are currently going without. There may be another in the list of unique qualities of the Delta variant. In early August, an internal CDC slide deck was leaked, revealing that researchers found Delta to be as contagious as the chickenpox and its effects to be more severe in nearly every demographic. One Baton Rouge infectious disease expert says she thinks it's a new COVID. Over-the-counter drugs affect older people. Most people don't pay much attention to the side effects of over-the-counter medications, especially if you're dealing with allergies or a nagging headache. However, as we get older, we need to start paying a lot more attention to those side effects. According to the Washington Post, while it's important for everyone to follow instructions for over-the-counters, it's essential for older adults. Jeffrey Colgren, an associate professor of internal medicine at the University of Michigan's Institute for Healthcare Policy and Innovation in Ann Arbor, says many seniors consider these over-the-counter medications harmless, but they're drugs, and the older you get, the more susceptible you are to their side effects. It's also important to know that some of the over-the-counters are more appropriate for older adults than for others. Also, over-the-counter drugs you tolerated well in the past can be problematic as you age. The Washington Post provides some guidelines to help individuals make better decisions when choosing an appropriate over-the-counter drug. To ease pain and fever, consider using acetaminophen like Tylenol, as it's the best for most people.
For arthritis pain, one option is over-the-counter NSAID gel Voltaren, but be cautious with ibuprofen, naproxen, and other oral non-steroidals, which can cause side effects such as gastrointestinal bleeding with chronic use. For a nagging cough, consider using products such as Mucinex, which thins mucus in your lungs so you can bring it up more easily. Drinking plenty of fluids is also helpful. Be cautious with multi-symptom cold and cough remedies that contain the decongestants phenylephrine or pseudoephedrine. These ingredients are sometimes not advised for older adults because they can drive up blood pressures, affect sleep, and cause urination problems. Also, the antihistamine diphenhydramine, which is also called Benadryl, is often found in over-the-counter nighttime cold and cough medicines, has been linked to dizziness, sleepiness, and cognitive impairment in seniors. Certain over-the-counter cough and cold products also contain acetaminophen, so if you're already taking acetaminophen on your own, you run the risk of an accidental overdose. To reduce allergy symptoms, consider using an over-the-counter steroid nasal spray such as Flonase, Nasacort, or Rhinocort Aqua. A simple saline spray can also help, but be cautious with antihistamines like chlortrimetenon and Tavist unless your doctor advises it. These often cause sedation, especially in older adults. Avoid Benadryl because it's an anticholinergic, a type of drug that has been linked to higher risk of dementia in older people. For heartburn, consider using an antacid with calcium carbonate, such as Tums or Pepcid, but be cautious with Prilosec or Zegerid. They can lead to low magnesium and vitamin B12 and increase the risk of bone fractures, pneumonia, and serious Clostridium difficile infection if used for long periods. Listeners, encourage your senior loved ones to talk to their doctors about any medications they're on, even if they're on over-the-counters. This new virus is a good thing. After having experienced almost 2 years of a deadly global pandemic caused by a virus, it is very difficult to imagine a scenario where viruses might be useful. However, scientists have discovered a virus that may be beneficial to humans. According to BBC News, scientists working at the Institute of Food Research in Colney, England, said that the Colney virus could potentially treat deadly Clostridium difficile infections. This is also known as C. diff. C. diff bacteria infects the bowel most commonly during a course of antibiotics, which can cause diarrhea, inflammation, and fever. The bacteria has been a major issue for hospitals around the world, and it is hoped that the Colney virus would form part of the treatments to combat C. diff after future research is done. Named after a very small village with a population of only 120 people, the Colney virus is a bacteriophage. That's a type of virus that infects bacteria, and it is also known as a bacteria eater. Phages exist and reproduce by injecting their genetic material into bacteria and using the host's own machinery to construct new viruses inside the cell. They then release enzymes called endolysins that destroy the bacteria's cell wall, which now releases the new viruses. Most importantly, Colney virus bacteriophage doesn't affect other bacterial species that commonly make up the human gut microbiome. Researchers say that the Colney virus could potentially save the lives of so many people affected by C. diff infections. If further research continues to prove that the Colney virus is beneficial to humans, this is one virus that I hope will stick around. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right. Thank you.
connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/kboomradio.
And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/kboo.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/kboo radio.
We also provide content to the Free Music Archive,
an interactive library of high-quality legal audio downloads.
That's at freemusicarchive.org/curator/kboo.
You can find all of this and more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.
Thanks for listening.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break as the minutes